It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says that 50 years after the March on Washington, it's time to start marching again.
First, though, we're going to take a look at gun laws in Wisconsin.
In today's political climate, laws that deal with guns often split people across party lines.
This may not be the case, though, for a new proposal by State Senator Alberta Darling.
After speaking with law enforcement officials in Milwaukee, the senator is now drafting a bill that would enact harsher penalties for those who possess firearms illegally.
And our guest Bill Leader says that support for the measure could be bipartisan. Bill is the Money and Politics Project Manager for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, thanks for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the bill. What measures does it include as it's being drafted so far?
Well, the bill is in drafting, so by definition, we can't see exactly what is in it yet. But what the chief of police of Milwaukee, Edward Flynn, has asked for, and he has been working with Senator Darling and her staff in the drafting of this bill, is to increase the penalties, create a mandatory 3-year prison term for anyone who qualifies as a habitual offender and commits a gun violation, a gun-related violation. So an habitual offender under state statute is anyone who has one felony conviction or at least 3 separate misdemeanor convictions within the prior 5-year period. If someone who has that criminal history is caught in illegal possession of a firearm, this would trigger a mandatory 3-year term.
And one of the unusual things about this bill as it's being drafted so far is that it seems to have, in Wisconsin, an unusual amount of bipartisan support. Tell us about that.
Well, the bill is something that Edward Flynn, the police chief of Milwaukee, has wanted for a long time. It's also supported by Tom Barrett, who, of course, the office of Milwaukee is a nonpartisan office, but Tom Barrett is clearly a Democrat since he ran as a Democrat against Scott Walker for governor. But the governor, Scott Walker, has said that he is open to the idea of increasing penalties on people who commit gun-related offenses, so long as this does not interfere with the rights of law-abiding citizens. He said that he is all for that. As we've mentioned, the bill is being introduced by a Republican state senator. I would assume that it would have bipartisan support. That is what Joel Plant, the chief of staff of the Milwaukee Police Department, told me. There is some sense among Democrats that they want to make the case that this type of legislation isn't all that needs to be done, that we really need to get a better system of background checks in place in the state of Wisconsin. That's a bill that the Democrats have introduced and backed, and they responded to Darling's bill by saying, well, why don't you pass this instead? But I think when it comes down to it, with the support of Tom Barrett and with the support of the chief of police of Milwaukee, the Democrats are going to support this bill as it's been introduced by a Republican.
Now, Mayor Barrett and Governor Walker have been at odds a lot. There's been a lot of sallies going back and forth the past year or so. Does this represent an olive branch at all, or is this just a piece of legislation that's a no-brainer for people?
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I think there will be people who won't like the idea of a law that creates a mandatory sentence, both because mandatory minimums are controversial in and of themselves and because it represents a crackdown of sorts against guns, and it's going to have some lack of support. I did talk to someone or communicate with someone, I should say, with Wisconsin Carry Incorporated, an organization that supports concealed carry, who was pretty cool to the idea of new legislation restricting guns. So I don't know that it will have universal support. It is extraordinary that Tom Barrett and Scott Walker would agree on anything. In fact, one of the points I made in the column is if you Google the first 3 words of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel headline on the story that reported this, the first 3 words are Walker, Barrett agree. Type that into Google and that story will come right up.
It's the one thing that comes up.
It's the only time those 3 words have ever appeared together on the internet.
Maybe the last. We'll have to see about that. Yeah. So this could be a sea change, but it could be that, you know, it's an interesting time in Milwaukee's history, too. Now, tell us a little bit about what occasioned this bill to come about.
Well, the Senator Darling proposed this in early August, right around the time that Milwaukee saw a spate of gun violence. During a 1-week period in early August, there were 23 people shot in the city of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. 7 of them died from their wounds. It was something that got the attention of the senator, and she said that her proposal was in part a response to that. And of course, the police chief of Milwaukee has been saying for a long time that he needs more tools to deal with the problem of habitual criminals who get guns and who are able to continue to possess guns no matter how often they get arrested, because most of the time the offenses are not going to put them away for a good long time.
Now, is this seen as a tweak to existing legislation, or is this seen as more significant than that?
I would think that it's more significant because it creates a mandatory minimum. It would have a significant fiscal cost, I would imagine. I mean, if you you look at the reaction to this, was also proposed by Alberta Darling, the toughening of state drunk driving laws, that comes with a considerable fiscal cost because you're locking up people for lengths of time. That there's going to put additional pressures on the prison system. So I think it's significant as a piece of legislation.
Can you give us a sense of what other gun-related legislation might be in the pike here in Wisconsin besides this?
Well, there are a few things that gun supporters have wanted, and those bills appear to be advancing. Of course, we've heard about the crossbow, the expanded use of crossbow. That is backed by gun lobby groups, the National Rifle Association, Wisconsin Gun Owners, Inc. They support that measure, and that has moved forward. There is a bill that would eliminate the restrictions that are currently in place on hunting with a bow and arrow near schools and hospitals. There are certain local rules that would be eliminated with that statute. And there's another provision that would exempt bird hunting preserves from noise nuisance laws that the NRA and other gun groups are supporting. So there are a number of things that are kind of tangentially related to the issue of guns and weapons that are moving forward. There are also a number of bills that the Democrats have introduced which don't appear to be moving forward. The most important in their mind is to toughen the rules for background checks so that every gun sold, or most every gun sold in the state of Wisconsin, would require some sort of background check to see if the person is legally prohibited from buying that weapon now at gun shows and
in
private sales.
You said that was not moving forward.
That is not going anywhere. That was introduced in April. It has not had a hearing. It has not had any sort of committee action. There's also a Democrat-backed bill that would ban assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, another bill to deal with hollow-point bullets and other kinds of ammunition, and a bill that would ban concealed weapons in the Capitol, which has been allowed since the passage of the concealed carry law. None of that legislation appears to be moving forward.
Interesting. But this one piece does look promising, I guess, on its bipartisan legs.
Yeah, I think that, because Republicans control the legislature and because the governor has indicated his support, it's likely to have a good, strong chance of becoming law in the state. I get the sense from the little I was able to learn from the position of the gun groups, they may not be fully supported of this. And as I said, the Democrats are going to say, well, you know, why aren't you backing some of these other measures? If you really want to address this issue, these are the things that we think ought to be done. And we're going to hear that argument raised again.
What do you see as the next step? It's in drafting right now. What comes after this?
The bill should come under drafting in the next couple of weeks, as I understand it, and then it will be introduced to the legislature, assigned to a committee. Presumably, it will be scheduled for hearings, and then anyone with a opinion on the bill will have the chance to weigh in. Then the committee that holds the hearing will make a recommendation, whether its members support or oppose it, and make that recommendation to the legislature. And it can either be referred to another committee or scheduled for a vote. And then, of course, you know, to become law, it has to pass both houses and be signed by the governor.
Now, it's probably a stretch, but should the bill go forward, it's going to please Mayor Barrett. Looks like it would please Governor Walker. Are we looking at a new era of cooperation a little bit, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I would like to think so. I think it's good for the state when politicians can make common cause. I mean, irrespective of what the issue is. I'm not saying that this is good legislation or bad legislation, but we can certainly say that bipartisan cooperation is a rare thing in the state of Wisconsin, and that this would be an example of that happening.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
Very good to be here.
Bill Leder is with us today. He's Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
Now we'll take a look at the headlines. Then we'll hear why our next guest says 50 years out, it's time we march on Washington again.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March on Washington, and people gathered today in the nation's capital to remember that event. Our next guest says the issues raised in that original march are very much still with us, and he wants to see a revival of large-scale protest.
Ari Berman joins us. He's contributing writer for The Nation magazine. Ari, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you covered a march this last weekend, and then you were at today's commemoration event. Did you get a sense that it was a celebration without much current political content, or were people thinking, hey, we've got a lot of unfinished business here?
It was definitely the latter. If you looked at the rally on Saturday, it was really all about the unfinished progress of the civil rights movement. It was about the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in June and what has happened since in states with new voting restrictions being passed. It was about the killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman. Trayvon Martin's face was really omnipresent at that rally. It was about stop and frisk in New York City and what they viewed as wide-scale racial profiling. It was about the black unemployment rate being twice the white unemployment rate right now, nearly the same ratio as in 1963. So for all those reasons, it really wasn't a commemoration. It was, I would say, much more of a continuation or a call to action. And even today, as Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Carter spoke, they talked about the tremendous progress that we've made since 1963, but they definitely talked about these issues, whether it's voting rights, criminal justice, or the economy, that really are still very much unfulfilled today.
Do you think that the movement is out there, that there's a civil rights movement out there strong enough nowadays to recreate something as powerful as the 1963 march and all the other protests and boycotts around the country that we saw in the early 60s?
So it's very different because obviously there's been so much progress that there doesn't need to be the kind of civil rights movement that there was in the 1960s. In the 1960s, if you look at the states of the old Confederacy, African Americans were almost wholly disenfranchised. Today, there's a black president. So no one is arguing that 2013 is like 1963, but it's also true, for example, in places like North Carolina, where they've just passed the country's toughest new voting restriction, or you look at Florida with the Stand Your Ground law. There's clearly a need for a new wave of civil rights activism, and we are seeing more grassroots groups emerge. I've written about this for The Nation, but in North Carolina, for example, we have the Moral Monday movement, which has been compared to the movement we saw in Wisconsin that fought for working rights, but basically a multi-issue, multiracial grassroots movement that's fighting on a number of fronts. In Florida, we have the Dream Defenders, a group of young activists who began a sit-in after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, spent a month in the Capitol calling for the repeal of Stand Your Ground, and are now going to try to register 60,000 voters, which was the margin of victory of Florida Governor Rick Scott, who is now up for re-election next year. So I do think we're seeing the seeds of a new civil rights movement. I don't think we can really say there's a national civil rights movement like there was in 1963, but I think there is a new wave of activism in response to some of the recent things we've seen in this country.
Is public protest the kind of things you're talking about, is that relevant still in 2013? Is it the right platform, the right format to raise these issues?
I think when people feel frustrated with the political process, that's when they start taking to public protest. So you saw that in Wisconsin, right? When people felt like they didn't have a voice in the legislature, they decided to sit in the legislature so that people would pay attention in Wisconsin and they could try to force change in that state. I think the same thing happened in North Carolina. Republicans took over state government in North Carolina for the first time in over 100 years. They passed what Democrats and progressives down there viewed as a host of really, really radical policies on pretty much every single issue. People felt like their voices weren't being heard in the political process, so they had to go in. They had to sit in the state legislature. They had to get arrested, do the kind of nonviolent civil disobedience that happened in the 1960s to dramatize what was going on in the state. And if you look at what's happened, for example, in North Carolina, the legislature and the governor down there are very unpopular right now, and the protesters are quite a bit more popular. So that doesn't mean that it's all because of the protests, but the protests have shifted attention onto these issues. And then I think the next step is you take it from the protests, from the streets, into the electoral process. And I think the goal here, I think these activists hope, is that they'll have an impact in the 2014 elections and the 2016 elections, and the political process will be more responsive to their concerns.
Well, and does that work, though? I mean, in Wisconsin, you mentioned the protests, and then there was a recall election, and the governor won. He viewed that as an endorsement of his policies. The big protest didn't, at least in the short run, sway much of anything in the electoral process.
Well, they got people energized. They ultimately were unsuccessful at the electoral sphere, but they got people energized, and they encouraged protests elsewhere as well. So it's very possible that what's happening in North Carolina wouldn't have happened without Wisconsin going first. So I don't want to argue that it's something that always works, because clearly it doesn't. But I also think we don't know if it's going to work, because certainly there's the whole question of what will happen in the 2014 election. But just if you look at the numbers, for example, in North Carolina, the numbers of the legislature, the numbers of the governor down there, they have fallen sharply since the Moral Monday protests began.
Moving from the tactics of protest, I want to get more into some of the issues that you think have persisted since 1963. You mentioned voting rights. You mentioned the Trayvon Martin shooting as something that energized a lot of people. What other issues do you see brought up 50 years ago in the march that that you think we haven't solved yet, that you're hoping to see protests about?
Well, I think the whole criminal justice issue was really front and center. The mass incarceration of particularly African-American men, I think, was a very salient issue, particularly at the march and the rally on Saturday. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which mentions that there's more black men in prison today than were enslaved in 1850. The stats in that book, what's happening with the drug war, what's happening with what they call the school-to-prison pipeline, these deep structural issues are something that I think people really want to see addressed. They don't see politicians in either party really talking about it, but it's having an enormous impact on a lot of people. So I think the goal is to talk about some of the things that are obviously in the news, like Trayvon Martin, for example, but then to take a deeper look on things that are affecting millions of people every day that aren't getting discussed in the normal political debates.
That reminds me, a recent Pew survey found a lot of concern about civil rights in the United States. Fewer than half of Americans say there's been substantial progress made, and most black Americans say they're treated less fairly by police, courts, and other institutions. Does that surprise you to hear that?
Well, there's a very interesting disconnect between public opinion, particularly public opinion among people of color, and then the views of, for example, the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, because the court in particular is saying that these historic remedies for long-term discrimination, whether it's the Voting Rights Act or affirmative action or a fair housing case that's going to be heard next term, the Supreme Court's basically saying that we're past that we don't need those protections anymore, we don't need the same kind of stringent protections that we had before. And the public is saying something different, or at least parts of the public are saying something different, which is, yes, we've made a lot of progress, but these things are still very unsettled. And just look at what's happened, for example, since the Voting Rights Act decision. John Roberts in that decision basically said voting discrimination is largely a thing of the past. He didn't say totally, but he said largely a thing of the past. And since then, we've seen seven southern states pass or implement new voting restrictions that disproportionately impact people of color. And so there is this very interesting tension right now in our society between what's happening in the upper echelons of power and how people are feeling about these issues.
Before I let you go, just briefly, I mean, you've talked about what you still think needs to change. Is it worth taking time to celebrate some of the changes we've seen in the 50 years since the march?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's been happening all week. I mean, people have been celebrating President Obama. People have been celebrating Congressman John Lewis, who was the only surviving speaker there. But I think if we just celebrate it, we miss what made the movement so vital back then, and the fact that the reason to have these commemorations is not just to remember them like we're going to a museum, but to realize that these are still vital issues that we have to discuss and deal with in our society today.
Ari, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ari Berman with The Nation magazine. His piece on civil rights is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as wildfires rage in California, we'll talk to a guest who says big wildfires may be the new normal.
We will hear about the future of the Girl Scouts around the United States.
And we'll get some old school cookout tips in time for Labor Day with a look at vintage grilling recipes.
I think I'll need to pay attention to that and maybe run home and grill afterward. Well, that's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. At parties, in the elevator, at work, on the plane, it's pretty hard to avoid small talk.
Some people think that chit-chat is petty or a waste of time, but a lot of people who are experts on this stuff say it's an important social ritual that helps us make new friends, among other things.
And you can get better at small talk with practice. If you don't naturally have the gift of gab, we're going to have some tips now on being a better small talker.
I'll be listening closely. I need some tips.
No reason why.
Yeah, right. Are you good at small talk? We want to hear from you. Do you like small talk or do you dread it? Do you break out in a cold sweat? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
Our guest is Elizabeth Bernstein, a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and her piece, How to Be a Better Conversationalist, appeared in The Wall Street Journal. And Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Rob and I were talking before the show, talking about how Rob feels like he struggles with small talk. Mm-hmm. It is an important skill, you say, though. Tell us a little bit about why.
It's a very important skill. And I think some people feel like, oh, it's simple. It's not something I should have to worry about. A lot of men feel like, oh, it's a female thing. Let them chit chat. But the deal with small talk is that it's really social grease. It helps us form relationships, and relationships are important. They help us in the workplace. They help us form families, support networks, all sorts of things. And so this kind of forging, this opening to a relationship is actually essential.
Now, I am a man, and I don't feel it's just a woman's thing. I want to be good at it, but is it just a built-in thing, or can someone actually learn to get good at small talk?
You absolutely can learn to get good at it. It's not something that everyone is good at. Sometimes people are naturally good at it. Maybe people come from families where they're all big talkers. Women tend to talk more, even as children. They're socialized to talk more. So they tend to be a little bit better at it overall, generally, if you want to make a broad generalization. That's not to say every woman is good at it and every man's not. But you can definitely learn. You can learn. That's the good news. You can definitely practice. And there's little keys to work on.
Is there a case to be made that everybody is getting worse at small talk because so much of what we do now is avoiding talking to people? We text people, we email people, we do everything we can not to talk to them in person. So does that mean conversation is suffering?
Absolutely. And researchers, social psychologists are very worried about this with the younger generations. Will teens and children, will they not learn to have a conversation in person? They won't learn to read cues such as body language or facial expressions. And but across the board, all of us spend so much more time, as you're saying, hiding behind a screen of some kind, maybe having some type of connection with each other, but it's not the same as in person. And that is going to harm us as a society.
So what advice do you have for someone who's nervous about making the first move and striking up a conversation with someone at a party, at on the sidelines of the kids' soccer game, whatever?
Well, the thing that makes it so hard for people is they often feel that they feel so nervous, like it's all, the focus is all on them. And so what they need to do is sort of focus on the other person. This is really the golden rule of small talk. You're going to make the other person more comfortable and therefore yourself more comfortable if you ask about the other person. And you can open, an opening line can be anything like, hey, it's such a cliche, but hey, the weather, how about this weather? It's super hot right now. That kind of thing. Always works. Everybody's interested in the weather.
And what about other things that we can do once we get past that initial icebreaker?
So once you get past the initial icebreaker, and in fact, I was interested when I started to work on this article to find out that there, researchers actually think there's five stages of conversation. So that first one is the opening line. The second one is sort of a personal introduction. You're fishing for a topic. You want to sort of say who you are. Even if you're in an area, say you're in line at the coffee shop and you don't want to introduce yourself, you still want to give some sense of who you are. Hey, you work around here? Oh, me too. That kind of thing. So you're sort of giving a sense of who you are, finding out a sense of who that person is.
You know, maybe it's I've got some like British in me or something. I'm nervous to like bring up subjects that could be like, oh, what do you do for a living? Oh, I just got fired or something like that. I don't want to like have accidentally walk into some faux pas with that brings out bad news and turn someone away.
Absolutely. That's why the weather is always a good one. It's always there. And it's pretty broadly is icky for all of us or great for all of us at the same time if you're in the same place. So that one is a great one. But you're right. There's certain topics that you want to avoid. It seems like it shouldn't need to be said, but certainly you never want to mention to a woman if she's, you know, hey, when's the baby due?
I've been the victim of that one.
Yeah, me too.
When I was pregnant, thankfully.
When you were pregnant. I've sadly been the victim when I wasn't. So it's just really bad. That was just a bad dress choice, I like to tell myself. But you want to keep it simple, but you can give open-ended questions too. So, you know, or much more broad questions. Like, again, like, do you work around here? Oh, you know, I need your afternoon coffee fix. These kinds of things. If you're in a networking event, like, oh, how'd you hear about this? Things that might not you might not step into the bad answer that you don't want to come up with somebody's personal sticking point.
Well, one safe way to go is listening, right? I mean, we had a couple of commenters on our Facebook page who said the best way to be a good conversationalist is to listen, which I don't know, Rob, in your case might mean you're just mute and you're sitting there. But I mean, can you listen too much in a conversation?
Certainly, because I think listening is a good skill if you're really genuinely listening. But the problem is, if you listen too much, you're really letting the other person do almost all the work of the conversation. There is work to keep it going. And so you should shoulder, you know, half of that burden at least. And you want to – the goal and what will make you a good conversationalist is really making that other person at ease in that conversation. And so you really want to do the work of that.
You give one example in your article of a pratfall on the other end talking too darn much and taking all the work on yourself. How do you know when you're pushing that limit?
Well, you always have to be aware of that. Some people more so than others. I usually have to be aware of it. But I did. I interviewed somebody who said, you know, he was at a party and he was trying to impress some women and he kept talking and talking and talking. And the more they sort of politely asked questions, the more he thought he was fascinating. And finally, in the end, they asked him to stop. So, you know, it really backfired. So you have to, this is where we have to be good at small talk because we have to read those social cues. I mean, the physical cues of someone's, you know, nodding off, their eyes are glazing over, they're sneaking peeks at their watches. These are all cues that you're talking too long.
Now, when I've been chatting with friends of mine who spend time in Ireland or who are Irish, they often say, you know, in America, we don't know how to have small talk. And in Ireland, you spend so much time. You talk to the bus driver and the shopkeeper and, you know, your child's teacher. And they consider it such a pleasant part of the texture of the day, apparently, in Ireland. Do you think that Americans were, you know, as a culture, less good at small talk to begin with?
I think it's relative to whatever other culture you're talking about, because Americans, by certain cultures, maybe certain Asian cultures or, the Brits, they could be considered big talkers, like too much small talk. So relative to the Irish, yes, like I think that we could work on our gift of gab. It's interesting that Americans, too, I thought this was fascinating. They are known to talk about work. So within the first, you know, few minutes, 2 minutes of a conversation, they'll try to nail down. What do you do for a living, as you were saying? There's other cultures where that's just taboo. And in much of Europe, apparently, they don't. They will talk about you can go through a whole conversation and not know. It's not the focus of trying to understand who someone is.
We'll go to the phones now. We've got full phone lines. We've got Leo in Madison with us. Leo, hi. You're on the air.
Hey. So I just got back from a semester abroad. And so I was, like, kind of forced to get out of my shell a bit and, like, definitely noticed that I've like improved at small talk, but especially that I enjoy it more. And I guess the biggest thing that I took from that was like just like being super genuinely interested in the person and like what they have to provide. And in doing that, I think as long as you're like focusing on them and like genuinely interested, it gets you out of your head. And I think like looking back, that was always like what would make me like strange in conversation if it would happen, is because like I was just in my head. And like I remember you saying something before, like worrying about like bringing up a faux pas or a taboo, and like I guess that's just like in your head mode. And if that does get brought up, just kind of like brush it aside, like whoops, and then just keep going and like just try and find like, it's like a dance and you got to find like the right thing going on, you know?
Hey, Leo, do you think that added a lot to your experience abroad?
Yeah, definitely. Once I got the hang of just like talking to strangers and travelers, like it was great. Like I met some of the most interesting people of my life for sure.
All right, Leo, thank you so much for sharing your story. Elizabeth, a pretty good pep talk for us there to get good at small talk.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Because I would imagine, well, exactly as Leo said, is he felt better at it. He felt he was getting better at it. He liked it more. And so that's, you feel competent at something, you enjoy it. But also he gave the best advice. Like if you are genuinely interested in the other person, that's fantastic. And you have to take your own self-consciousness away from it. The other person's probably just as nervous as you are, worried about, you know, what they're going to sound like. Just talk, show interest, ask about the other person, and you'll get it flowing.
We're talking right now with Elizabeth Bernstein. She's a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, talking about the virtue of conversation and why we should work at getting good at small talk.
And you can share your stories. Are you good at small talk? Do you like it or fear it? Call 800-642-1234, post on the Central Time Facebook page, or email talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our discussion now about how small talk, something a lot of people tend to dismiss as unimportant, is actually a necessary social tool that can make your life better.
You can share your stories, your fears, and your wisdom about small talk on the Central Time Facebook page or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal now. Elizabeth, what are a couple other tips that you can give us for rounding out that conversation?
So some people are so self-conscious that they worry that in the moment they won't quite know what to say or they won't know how to respond to the person. So one thing that experts told me was a great thing to do would be to think of questions in advance, sort of have some stable of simple things that you could talk about. So you sort of feel comfortable, almost like you practiced, you have this talking points you could go to. That's a good one. And also good conversationalists do not miss the follow-up question. So they know how to build on something. This goes back to what your caller was saying. You want to be listening to the other person genuinely instead of thinking of what you're going to say next. That's no good. The other person can see you doing that. You're not helping with the flow of the conversation. You want to be listening to what they're saying so you can respond to it.
We'll respond now to Marcus, who's with us in Green Bay. Marcus, hi, you're on the air.
Well, hello. It's very neat that you're having a show about this. A long time ago in the late 80s, I checked myself into a hospital, and I remember the psychologist was frustrated with me, and she asked me to list two things about myself that were positive. And the second one was, I'm a good elevator talker. And she really took that to the wind. And for a long time, we concentrated, and now it has become something that I recognize in myself. So I love these short conversations, and I think the reason why is because after more than a couple decades of depression, what was once a weakness has become a strength. I love focusing on the positive, you know, and whether like one of you folks said, the weather, you know, and oh, it's hot and humid, but oh, it's only going to last 2 days. And I just love them. They just make me feel so great. And I don't have that many friends and all that, but yesterday I was shopping at the grocery store with my ex-wife, and we kept bumping into this lady with her two children with the shopping carts, and she apologized real sincerely. Oh, I didn't mean it. And I said a few things about how, oh, it's neat though, but you know, it's exciting because, you know, we get to know each other or something. But and I used to embarrass my daughters about it and stuff, but those are the neatest things, these little connections with people, and to stay focused on the positive and listen to what they're saying, and then just bounce off one another. Right. I just think it's a great thing.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark, because I'm glad small talk was such a savior in a way in your life. Elizabeth, what do you think of his story?
I think it's a really great story to hear. It's depression is so isolating. That's one of the biggest problems with it, is it makes people withdraw, and then that just compounds the problem. And so the idea that sort of small talk can get you out, so maybe you can't sustain a full relationship or you don't have a ton of friends, but small talk makes it so much less isolating. It's fantastic. Those little connections and then focusing on the positive within them can really brighten a day, whether you have a gabillion friends or none, they're important.
So, Elizabeth, for people who are especially small talk challenged or fearful in the beginning, if you know you're going to an event and you know a couple of the people who are going to be there, you sort of know the lay of the land, is it too nerdy to prepare for it and write down some questions that you can open with?
No, not at all. Because certainly if you're going to a networking event, you want to make a good impression. You want to be there to connect with people. It's the whole point. So people are flattered when you know about them. People are very flattered if they say, oh, hey, I know you do X. You know, you don't want to know their blood type, and you don't want to be the creepy person. But, you know, if you just know like something that's obvious that you could, you know, Google pretty broadly, that's very nice. And then you do have something to talk about. Or the person that I interviewed for this article was going in for an interview, and he really did some time research the people who interviewed him, so he knew what they had in common with him, and he was able to build on that. Those are huge social skills.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. We have Stephanie with us in Mequon. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. Well, thankfully, I have the gift of gab, and I never feel like I'm among strangers, at least not for long. But instead of asking people what they do for a living, my question is, what do you love to do?
Mm. How do people respond when you ask them that?
Well, most of them are usually kind of startled because they're so used to hearing the question of what do you do for a living. But, you know, this gets that open conversation going, because when you ask somebody what they love to do, they will tell you.
Huh. I like that. I think that's a future show idea right there. Actually, that's a great idea. What do you think of that as a conversation starter, Elizabeth, that might catch people off guard at first?
It's beautiful. It probably catches some people off guard because so many of us are just focused on our work. I have talked to other people who have tried this approach. I think it's beautiful. One woman told me, you know, even if some people will stop and say, you know, I don't really spend enough time doing what I like, but wait, what would I like to do? And she feels like she's even helped people think about their lives in a different way. So it's a very connecting, interesting thing to do. Certainly a more fun conversation than how's work.
Well, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Victor, who is with us in West Allis. Hi, Victor.
Hi. Hey, I've been listening to your program. First of all, I'm a Wisconsin Public Radio supporter.
Oh, hey, thank you.
When I encounter people, the first thing we do is everybody wants to talk about the economy. And then I listen for a while. And then I said, you know, the problem with the economy is it possible that the planet Earth has too many people where we may never be able to supply enough jobs for everybody? And that really starts going into the conversation about the economy. It's amazing how many people really are interested in what's going on in the economy.
So it sounds like Victor has a conversational beat, a little area that he specializes in and he likes to go back to. That seems like a good tool.
Yeah, I think it's a great tool because, again, it goes back to this idea of sort of you have some, you know, ideas in your pocket about what you're going to talk to. But he seems to have also have mastered the follow-up questions, which are so important. So enough about, you know, just complaining about the economy. What do you think the solution is? What do you think what do you think this larger problem is? Why is this happening? So it's very, very good. He does sound like he's mastered it.
Is it dicey, though? I mean, that's a fairly political topic, could lead to some angry back and forth. Are there situations where you might steer clear of something like that?
Most people will say you steer clear of certain things like people's salaries or religion or the, you know, political issues. I was on the plane chatting the other day with a woman and we were having a pleasant talk about books. And then, you know, she wanted to talk about politics and we disagreed immediately. And I just finally had to say, I'm really sorry. I really enjoy talking to you. And can we go back to books? Because you just don't, sometimes you just don't want to have that argument or that discussion. So I feel like, yes, but it seems to work for that caller, so you never know. Who am I to say?
That's really interesting. So you were in a conversation with someone on a plane, and you went to that, she was going to that uncomfortable place. I think if I were in that situation, I might freeze or try to, you know, give noncommittal answers, but you were just blunt, and you said, let's not talk about this anymore. Is that okay?
I at the moment, maybe it was panic, but I thought, oh my gosh, we have 2 more hours of this flight. We were having a very nice conversation, but I felt my blood pressure rising. This woman does not know what she's talking about. So, I mean, who knows if I know what I'm talking about, but I could see we are just going to start arguing. And I was sort of desperate not to have that, to go back to this place where at least this is pleasant company. And it really was that we talked the entire 3 hour flight. And with, except for that brief 10 minutes or 5 minutes where, you know, I had to redirect us off of it. It was a great conversation, like a new friend.
We'll talk now with Brian in Oconomowoc. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to call in and say, you know, people really like to talk about themselves. So when I'm making small talk, which I do all too often, or just the right amount maybe, I like to pick up on anything, what they're wearing or what car they're driving or where we are, and just kind of ask them why they're there, why what, something about themselves.
And that usually gets them going?
Yeah, it does. I mean, sometimes the conversation can last anywhere, you know, 10 minutes, and we find out we're from right down the street from each other, even though we're halfway across the state or in another state. It's really cool.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. So just get people talking about themselves. Sounds like a rule that keeps coming up again and again.
Everybody, I pretty much, almost without exception, unless somebody's terribly, terribly shy, everybody likes to talk about themselves. Even a shy person, you can draw out by, you know, letting them know that you're genuinely interested in them. It is really the golden rule of conversation.
So what about gently disentangling yourself and ending a conversation? Because, you know, so often at events or parties, what have you, you have a nice conversation, you find some common ground, you enjoy, but you kind of want to mingle or the conversation runs its course. How can you gracefully end that?
And this is another skill. It's a great question because this is an art as well. You want to be able to get out of something sometimes earlier rather than later if it's not, you know, going well, or you're on a topic you don't feel like you can get out of. So I had readers write me a lot of tips. Some, you know, say, oh, excuse me, I told my mom I'd check in with her at 9. She's not feeling well. Or somebody, you know, has their, you know, excusing themselves for the restroom always. But again, researchers go back to the fact that there is like a set graceful way to get out of a conversation. You want to summarize it. First of all, you want to hint that it's about to end. Oh, hey, I'm having so much fun talking to you, but I really need to get going because X, you know, my wife's going to be calling. So then you sort of summarize what you said. I really enjoy talking about all those books. I'm going to check that book out. And then you want to sort of have an ability to reconnect if you want. Oh, hey, like, hey, do you have a business card or are you on Facebook? You know, if you want to reconnect with that person, you think you do. And then, you know, have your ending line, like great, great talking.
Elizabeth, it's been a lot of fun talking about small talk. I hope we can join you again for a future column. It's been a lot of fun talking.
Great. It has been great. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that was Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. I thought you did very well wrapping up the conversation.
I took her advice to the letter, and I think I put it to work. I will deploy that in the future in those fearful small talking.
Maybe not so robotically. Maybe a different word than deploy. But yeah, I think we're getting the hang of this. And coming up next, we'll talk about the hacking of the New York Times website and what that means for our cybersecurity.
News is coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.